Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout.com. Spout presents Butterknife, a new generation detective series made by a new generation of filmmakers. Find out more at butterknife.spout.com. And by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Log on to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting today for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Maddie Robinson. This week on the show, the kid stays out of the picture. Adam and I will share the top five actors we wouldn't cast in our movie.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by Mark Pickerel and his Praying Hands, and our Ingmar Bergman marathon concludes with a discussion of Fanny and Alexander.
We'll also spend a few minutes reviewing the new romantic comedy Definitely Maybe, but first, Jack Black and Mos Def ask you to be kind, rewind.
Look, look, look! All the tapes are blank!
It's the TV, man.
Show me how... Why is it doing that?
Does that happen when you do it?
Uh-oh. What is wrong with you? Why is it doing that when you do that? You're magnetized! You erased these tapes! It's you!
You gotta find new tapes.
I got a better idea. Follow me.
When you're walking down the street and you see a little ghost,
what
you gonna do about Ghostbusters?
What is that?
That's the Ghostbusters theme song.
No.
I'm pretty sure it is.
Something strange.
Stay where you are. I'm on my way.
Maddie, way back in August, Joran Kane from Valdosta, Georgia, was the first of many Film Spotting listeners to send in a link to the trailer for Michelle Gondry's Be Kind, Rewind. My then co-host, who it's fair to say was never afraid of a little hyperbole, responded thusly, "Let it be said now, the best movie of all time, case closed." My reaction was a little more staid, but also enthusiastic. "It's been a while since I laughed out loud at a trailer," I replied. "I'm just glad Mos Def isn't using his 16 blocks voice." Beyond the obvious hook that Gondry directed two recent Film Spotting favorites, The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and The Science of Sleep, it should really come as no surprise that the hosts of a show featuring a segment called Massacre Theater would get all giddy about a movie in which a video store clerk and his buddy restock the shelves of their rundown Passaic, New Jersey shop with their own no-budget VHS versions. I'm sorry, but Jack Black just destroying the Ghostbusters theme song and then saying with absolute conviction that he's pretty sure that's how it goes is comedy gold. Be Kind Rewind's concept is comedy gold, while also ripe with opportunities for Gondry to explore questions about creativity and art and perhaps even take a few shots at the Hollywood machine, turning out $100 million junk that is arguably less interesting and inspired than the literal junk produced by Be Kind's Mike and Jerry, films cobbled together from spare parts and imagination. But Maddie, that's the ultimate question, isn't it? Are Jerry and Mike's productions interesting and inspired enough to deliver the comedy gold? And more importantly, is Be Kind Rewind the best movie of all time, case closed?
Well, you put me in a really tough situation because no, it's not the best movie of all time. Sam Van Hyperbole is going to have to sleep on that for a little bit. The film does succeed, though, when Gondry matches the whimsy found in Mike and Jerry's productions. When that comes across in his film, Be Kind, Rewind, I am completely, completely with it. And I'm going to get to your Hollywood comment a little bit later on,
okay,
but I kind of want to go off on that tangent a little bit. What I like about Gondry is when he does more mainstream projects like Eternal Sunshine of the Mind.
The Spotless Mind, that's mainstream?
Yeah, that one. Well, it was it was much closer than Science of Sleep,
yes,
which I actually loved a lot more. But in these films, like Be Kind Rewind, he sets up a framework, and then he just sort of dances around in it. And so when I loved this film, when I thought it was at its best, is when I could see the wires that he was using.
Yeah.
Just as Jerry and Mike use a refrigerator to represent Hal in, you know, their version of 2001 A Space Odyssey, I liked it when I saw Gondry just sort of let the camera roll a little bit, when he would cast non-actors. You know, he lets them improvise. And when it works, you just sort of sit there and you smile. In the end, I think altogether it's just a little uneven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the plot, I think, is just a little scatterbrained. And the film meanders. You know, it becomes a little bit too precious at times and borders on the schmaltzy. But it is, again, that ingenuity that we see in Jerry and Mike carried throughout the rest of the film by Gondry. that, yeah, makes it a success.
Yeah, those parts really are what work about this film. Gondry is regarded as this very innovative, visually daring mm-hmm. filmmaker, and rightfully so, but when you really look at his films, he's not on the cutting edge of technology at all. He's all about this kind of do-it-yourself aesthetic yeah. that, of course, this film directly traffics in. That's exactly what our main characters are doing, and I think that line he walks is what makes him a fascinating director. And there are moments in this movie that perfectly illustrate it. There's one where we see Jack Black and Mos Def. They're going to sabotage a power plant. Don't ask, but it is what ultimately explains how Jack Black manages to erase all the tapes. And he's wearing this ridiculous camouflage that he gets Mos Def, Mike, to put on as well. And it doesn't look like real camouflage at all. It's really terrible. And you're wondering, what are they doing? Why are they wearing that? And then they try to climb over a fence, and these cops show up, and they freeze up against the fence.
Right.
And the camera pulls back to show the cops' point of view, and it's like an optical illusion, but their camo does perfectly blend in with the chain-link fence for
right.
a second.
And
I would actually believe that the cops don't see them.
That is a beautiful, beautiful moment, but I think it's set up just a little bit too much.
You're absolutely right. No, everything surrounding it doesn't work, but that moment is
yeah.
brilliant. And there's another one, too, where we see this movie is framed within this Fats Waller movie, where Danny Glover is this huge fan of Fats Waller. He's the one who owns this video store that's going to be demolished, and Jerry and Mike are trying to save it. We've seen this kind of plot a million times before. I mean, Barbershop is that same kind of, let's make enough money to save
right.
our favorite building. But there's this Fats Waller movie they try to make, their quote-unquote real movie. And they have these cardboard cutout cars to represent, you know, 1930s cars in Passaic or whatever. And when you see it on screen for 10 or 15 seconds, it looks like real cars moving on the road. You totally buy it. It's only when you look really close that you realize that they can't be real, and of course they aren't. But those are those great moments that really say everything the movie wants to say and does reflect Gondry's genius, but there just aren't enough of them throughout the film to sustain it.
No, I think you're right. And you're touching on exactly what I loved about this film. Necessity breeding creativity.
Mm-hmm.
The lower budget. I'm thinking of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, that beautiful scene where the players come. And of course, the audience are sort of laughing them at first because you have men playing women. You have people using, you know, handkerchiefs as blood. But then by the end, you're just enraptured
mm-hmm.
because you're sort of in awe of what they're able to accomplish. But you're absolutely right. And the problems of this film, one of the big ones is you and I think would both agree that watching Jack Black and Mos Def watch paint dry would probably be interesting.
Theoretically,
but I think directors sort of tend to fall in love a little bit too much, especially with Jack Black. And you think Werner Herzog did the same thing with Klaus Kinski, especially towards the end of that relationship. He would just keep the camera on Kinski because
mm-hmm.
you know he's going
to
do something.
Even to the film's detriment.
Exactly. He's going to do something crazy. And here we see that with Jack Black. You don't know what you're going to get. And Gondry just lets the camera roll because you know he's going to do something, and you're not always rewarded, unfortunately, and there are just too many scenes that just sort of go on like that.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right with Jack Black, and I also will say, I like Mos Def, but he is playing dumb and simple here, and it's not interesting. And
well, I think he's allowed to improvise too much.
Maybe
here.
So. It was disastrous in 16 Blocks. I know maybe that Bruce Willis film, I don't know if anyone bothered to see, but we reviewed it, and it's a case where he has to act like he's a little slow, and it just
mm-hmm.
drains every scene of any real energy. I think this is something we're going to touch on in the last segment of the show. He's like the anti-Jake Gyllenhaal. Let Mos Def be the smartest guy in the
yeah.
room, the guy in control,
Great point.
In Something the Lord Made or Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but watching him act dumb is not interesting.
You're right, and there are some actors I would rather watch them act dumb, like
yeah.
Tim Robbins, not Mos Def. But I want to get back just really quickly and touch on your digs at Hollywood.
Okay.
Because I actually...
I'm saying maybe Gondry's taking digs at Hollywood.
Well,
I'm not sure I buy that or not.
No, I don't think he is. I actually, because you look at the movies that Mike and Jerry are spoofing, look at the titles that they're actually spoofing.
They're all big budget
Ghostbusters
Hollywood movies.
And Rush Hour 2, and those are the films that people relate to. Those are the films that they want to see. People aren't walking into Be Kind Rewind asking for 8.5, you know, or...
True.
Or, you know, something one of us pedantic, you know, film critics would want to see.
Fanny and Alexander.
Fanny and Alexander, exactly.
Yeah.
They're asking for what they've seen, and I think it's a testament to the impact that those films have, especially Ghostbusters.
Sure.
That obviously resonates with people.
It does, but you can ask yourself whether or not Gondry is necessarily trying to take a shot in the respect that maybe the films they're making are more fun, are more entertaining, in some way, quote-unquote, better than what Brett Ratner gives you in Rush Hour 2.
Well, that's, with Rush Hour 2, I think.
It could
exactly,
be.
Exactly, perhaps.
Well, I do have to say that even though I do like a lot about this film, and I am recommending it, mainly because I love the movie's spirit. You touched on this, that the reenactments are definitely hilarious in a lot of cases, but I do think it's kind of a mess. I mean, what is Mia Farrow doing in this film? What is Melanie Diaz, who plays Alma? She's this character who comes in sort of maybe as a love interest, like a true third character in this film, and then she all of a sudden disappears. And she was really great, by the way, I have to mention, in American Son, my favorite film from Sundance. She's really talented. She just gets left behind at some point about halfway through this film. And so I'm not sure what was happening there. And I do feel bad ripping on this movie, because in doing so, you almost feel like you're ripping on, I think, the films of Mike and Jerry, that they're not polished enough. And so this film isn't polished enough either. You're turning into, you know, an Anton Ego from Ratatouille who doesn't get the joke. And maybe you're even suggesting that art should just maybe be kept to the professionals and not these amateurs. I certainly don't feel that way, but I didn't buy for a second that people would pay money to buy and watch and love these films, or even that Mike and Jerry could turn them out fast enough to sustain business. I'm sorry, the premise just... He wants it to be serious enough.
They want you to suspend your disbelief.
I know, and I couldn't do it here. I couldn't, because there was too much else about the film that is a little schmaltzy, that is sentimental, and is serious, and is not over-the-top comedic. I mean, the villains in this movie, the people that want to tear down the building, they're not cardboard cutout villains at all.
No.
It's like he wants you to buy into a real story, and yet there's all this ridiculousness with the movies they're turning out. I couldn't suspend disbelief enough.
I think you think it's a little bit more of a mess than I do, but I would recommend it.
Okay, I do too.
All right, well, moving on, because we want to touch a little bit here on Definitely Maybe. Now, when I campaigned to join Film Spotting, I ran on a platform of inclusion and salvation, of including more romantic comedies in the Film Spotting rotation and saving your marriage, Adam Kempinar, and from the 200 hours a week you spend on Film Spotting. Now, I'm a sucker for a good romantic comedy. I've been on record saying that. I'll admit it. And it's my sister's influence, okay? Growing up, I had my movies, Roadhouse, Major League, and she had hers. Anything with Hugh Grant, Love Potion number 9, While You Were Sleeping, Sleepless in Seattle. All the movies seem to have sleep
Anything
in the
with
title.
Sleep in it.
Exactly. Well, those were the movies I was forced to watch when she had control of the TV. I would also like to say my sister's getting married in August, and I'd like to offer her congratulations. And they just bought a house in Uptown Minneapolis. So
fantastic.
Congratulations to Marit there. But I want to know, last week you were able to take in Definitely Maybe, the new romantic comedy with Ryan Reynolds and Abigail Breslin and Isla Fisher. With your wife. So
yes.
I want to know, can we now look forward to a Nora Ephron marathon, or as one listener said, a Nora Ephronathon? And can I add marriage counselor to my ever-expanding padded resume?
You might be able to, because other than for her birthday when my sister took my wife out, that was the first movie Sarah had been to in about 2 years. And then she got to go with me to see Definitely Maybe. And we both liked the movie. Right. I can absolutely say I liked it and can recommend it. And it is another case, though, where, like Be Kind Rewind, maybe the premise just isn't quite believable enough for me in terms of how it's executed. This whole gimmick, the framework for it, of course, is that Ryan Reynolds is telling his 11-year-old daughter, Abigail Breslin, how he came about meeting
his... Would never happen.
No. And just the way it plays out. There are certain things about it that don't work. But I loved Isla Fisher, of course, from Wedding Crashers in this. I liked the characterizations of all three of the love interests here. I thought they were all unique, and there were very different things about those women that would make them attractive to Will Hayes, and then also very different things, I think, that would turn someone off, potentially. And I don't know that any one of the characters in this film was really fleshed out as much as I would have liked, especially the main character, Will, played by Ryan Reynolds. We never really get a sense of how he's managed to survive and pay the bills every week. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit of a literalist here. I want some believability. But the movie does have this kind of built-in excuse, in that the device is that he's telling it to his daughter, as I mentioned. So, of course, it can be loose with the facts and jump all over the place, and it's not going to be completely developed like a normal narrative. But the fact is, Kevin Kline has a really juicy, fun, extended cameo in it as this drunk writer. I had fun with the movie.
Yeah, I totally had fun too. I didn't love it. It's one of those things where I actually loved the last third of the film better than I liked the setup. I thought when things started falling into place, I was more willing to go along with it. The person I went with said it was refreshing to see three presentations of strong, intelligent, and beautiful women.
Don't tell that to Ellen Page.
Well, fine. Well, I couldn't agree more. I think that's terrific. But at the same time, you have to give them something to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't quite buy into all their stories.
No.
I felt that it was just sort of playing at something. Like, oh, hey, it's kind of fun. This is set back in 1992. Let's set a sketch against that, and we'll mention Nirvana. It just didn't really seem real,
vested in reality.
And that was my big problem.
That's what I'm saying,
yeah. But you're absolutely right. My new nemesis, Ryan Reynolds.
Really?
This man, he's like Ken doll gorgeous.
Uh-huh.
And I can't compete against that. Now, it's fine. It's fine when you have Tom Hanks or Billy Crystal or, you know, sort of dorky skinny. That's me. You know, Michelle Pfeiffer dated Fisher Stevens for a while. That's me. I can do that. I can't compete against Ryan Reynolds.
No.
There's no way. I've been dating above my weight class for years, and Ryan Reynolds is going to destroy that.
Yeah, but he comes along. He's a little bit cardboard cut out.
He isn't. He's not the next Tom Hanks.
No,
which a lot of people have kind of been hyping him as.
Maybe so, but I do like one thing about this film is that it doesn't give us too many details or try to analyze why Will and his wife, who we are going to figure out in the end, it doesn't explain why that's happening.
We
just sort of
have
to buy it as a fact of love. Divorce is part of it sometimes, and I think it's really grounded in the way it looks at love, and it has the guts to show us that things don't always work out like they do in the movies. Great people come in and out of your lives, sometimes really passionately, and then they just burn out. That's all great, but then the movie at the end, I'm sorry, it pulls its punches, and it tries to do exactly that. I guess I'm just enough of a cynic to wish that it hadn't felt the need to leave me with a huge smile on my face and have the happy ending. There's a perfect point, Maddie, where this movie could have ended. So perfect, in fact, I think Adam Brooks maybe intended the film to end there. It really seems like the end of the movie, and then all of a sudden, I don't know if the studio got to him and the test audiences or what, they wanted that ending tacked on, but they tack on the Hollywood story.
But he hadn't given the book back yet.
I know.
Even I noticed that.
Now you're giving away some spoilers here, Maddie, but you know what? I actually think that's a flaw of the screenplay. We shouldn't get into it here because we don't want to give anything away too much. But again, that doesn't necessarily counter my problem with the film. I think it could have ended on a more cynical note and still been a really good film, a better film.
All right. You and I had different. I actually liked the last third. You liked the first three quarters.
That's right. Okay. Well, Definitely Maybe and Be Kind Rewind are both in theaters now. If you agree or disagree with our take, send an email or short MP3 clip to feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. Please, please don't tell me that my most trusted film minds are going to completely ignore Mookie and Tina and do the right thing. Your Top 5 Love Scenes feedback is up next. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and we will get to a great batch of love scenes feedback here in a minute. We also have our poll questions to share with you, but we wanted to share just a few notes. Last week on the show, we did mention, Maddie, that we thought we were going to review Jumper.
Yeah, you were going to put me through that.
I was going to subject you to Jumper, the new Doug Liman film with Hayden Christensen.
Unfortunately, there was nothing that looked remotely interesting about that film.
I wanted to give Doug Liman the benefit of the doubt, but looking at the reviews, and I haven't read any, but just looking at the scores, Metacritic, a score of 35. And what's interesting, if you look at Metacritic, guess what other movie recently released has a score in the 30s? That would be Awake with Jessica Alba and Hayden Christensen.
Wow.
So it hasn't been a good couple
rare
months.
Rare air to be in that company.
I know, but we decided to hold off on Jumper. We thought you would enjoy a review of Be Kind Rewind instead, so that's what we went with. Also, we did want to mention something we mentioned last week on the show, that our Film Spotting course, Film Study with Film Spotting, we will have a course on Michael Curtiz and Howard Hawks this spring at the University of Chicago. If you want to learn more information about that, you can get that information at filmspotting.net. I also brought up last week, Maddie, Pedro Almodovar, our next marathon. We're
going to
watch
how you say it.
Almodovar. Six of his films, and that is how you say it. We got this email, many emails like this, but I want to share this one from Ian in Barbados, who writes, Adam, you are stressing Don Pedro's name correctly, Almodovar. It has an acute accent on the second O. Where you see an accent in Spanish, it is always on the stressed syllable. Yours in pedantry, Ian. I do appreciate the email, Ian, and the ones I got from everyone to make sure that, yes, I was in fact saying it right. The stress is there, but the stress is actually what was confusing me a little bit, because why else would everyone else be saying it differently if it's so obvious that the stress is
there? You worry. This is where you and I differ. You worry so much what other people think.
You do this show for two or three more years, you get the pedantic emails from our wonderful listeners, and you'll be just as nervous about it as I am.
Never.
Okay. We will see about that. We do also want to get into another segment of Maddie's Movie Minute.
Maddie's Movie Minute.
You saw another movie last
weekend. Maddie tells me what movies I need to see, what movies I should
avoid. Is
that
our jingle?
No, I'm working on it. I think we should have a contest.
Maybe we need to bring in an actual singer. We've got a lot of musicians in our audience, but you saw The Spiderwick Chronicles.
Yes, and I want to thank Rory and Padma Singh for letting me borrow their kids this weekend, though they seemed actually more than happy to let me borrow them.
They let you take their kids out.
We were all in the same theater. They knew where I was. There's no GPS tracking device or anything like that. They took in No Country for Old Men while Uncle Maddie got to watch Spiderwick Chronicles with 13-year-old Swetha and 9-year-old Vadim. I have to say, it's a nice little movie. Really nice special effects. I don't think it transcends the children's movie genre enough. The dialogue just isn't quite that engaging. But I will have to say this. It is very, very scary. And I want to let you know how I know this. It's this family defending their house, basically, from this army of goblins. And it's a nice sort of Stephen King.
Led by Nick Nolte.
Exactly, which is scary enough. Mm-hmm. And Vadim, 9 years old, basically had his head buried in my armpit for the better part of the film until this one moment where these goblins are actually coming up through the floorboards. Wham! Vadim screams. He pulls this Nadia Comaneci. His leg just sort of kicks this cherry Coke, and I'm splattered. I missed about 5 minutes of the movie. Afterwards, I asked him for his reaction to the film, and he basically was giving me a play-by-play of the plot. I mean, this guy is going to be a talk show radio host or going to sell insurance because he could just talk. And I learned this is his second time seeing the film.
Really?
I took him on Sunday. He had already seen it.
And he was still that
scared.
He
was still scared, and he loved every minute out of it. Just the resilience of youth.
Not a film I can say I am really dying to see. What star rating, then? We do give star ratings on the filmspotting.net site. What would you give it on
the
5-star scale?
I'd give it a solid 3 stars, especially for the animation.
Okay, well, I would also give 3 stars to the movie I'm going to briefly mention here. We don't have a clever name for Adam's Movie Minute segment. I don't know. We need some alliteration there. But I did want to mention briefly Diary of the Dead, the new George Romero film. I think it's his 5th zombie movie that is out now in theaters.
Is it as scary as Spiderwick Chronicles?
It may be. No, actually, it's not really scary at all. And I do just want to say, you know, if you want more information about it, you want to check out the plot and everything, we'll put a link to the trailer on our website so you can learn more about it. I do just want to say I'd give it 3 stars as well. Go see it. I think it's a lot of fun. I don't know if it's a lot of fun for people who aren't into the other Romero films or aren't into that zombie as satire genre, but, you know, it's got some nice touches to it. I think maybe he pushes it a little bit too far. It's one of these films within a film where you have a film student making a zombie movie who then decides to make sort of a documentary, a real zombie movie, documenting the fact that there are zombies who have come to life and are eating everyone.
How is the production quality on those films?
It's a Romero film. I mean, the production value is up from Dawn of the Dead and certainly those movies from, you know, the late 70s and 80s. But, you know, you're going to get that whole thing with Romero all the time where the satire is just, he's just hammering you over the head with it. And I don't know if that's something really to be upset about because it's satire. It's supposed to be kind of a blunt instrument. And it is here, this whole idea that we're all voyeurs and we're really the zombies. But the fact is you get a lot of bad acting and you get these moments where characters say things like in one instance, a character picks up a camera. There's a second camera. This filmmaker, he won't put the camera down. It's like the anti-Cloverfield where I talked about how I couldn't believe no one said to the guy, Hud, hey, why don't you put the camera down? Mm-hmm. Here, they're saying it to him all the time. They're saying, just no, really, put the camera down. Well, he never will. And at one point, another character picks up a camera and then he puts it down in disgust and he says, here, take this. It's too easy to use. Making a whole kind of gun reference, and there's about a million of them throughout the film, like, these are just as dangerous, these cameras, as guns. And it's so heavy-handed, and yet at the same time, that sort of intentionally unintentional humor is one of the reasons you go to a Romero film, I think. So it's
all right, you're taking up far too much of Maddie's Movie Minute here. Give me a solid star rating.
I gave it to you 3 stars. I say, go see it. That's the end of Maddie and Adam's Movie Minute. Let's get to our poll questions then. And last week on the show, with the Oscars coming up, we wanted to know what film you thought deserved Best Picture. So we asked you, the Oscar for Best Picture should go to Atonement, Juno, Michael Clayton, No Country for Old Men, or There Will Be Blood. And Maddie, what do our listeners think? What film do they love?
No real surprise. Number one, No Country for Old Men with 53%. There Will Be Blood, the closest, coming in at second with 30%. Atonement, your favorite, only getting 8%, along with Juno 8%, and Michael Clayton trailing with only 2%.
That's almost exactly how I would have had it come out. So I'm happy to see those results, and we'll see what happens on the 24th, obviously, with the Oscars. And we're still keeping an Oscar theme for our next question, and we're going to have a production meeting here on the air, Maddie. We never decided which poll question we're going with. Do we want to go with Best Actress or Best Supporting Actress? Which one's more interesting, do you think?
Well, you know what? They're actually both really tight this year. Why don't we do Best Actress?
Okay, let's go ahead and try to decide who's going to win Best Actress. The nominees are...
The nominees are Cate Blanchett for Elizabeth, The Golden Age. Julie Christie for Away From Her.
We don't have all night.
Marion Cotillard for La Vie en Rose. Laura Linney for her work in The Savages. Or Ellen Page.
Nice. Was that kind of your Donald Sutherland announcer voice, or what was that?
Sure, let's call it Donald Sutherland.
Well, you heard our picks last week on the show. You, in a surprise move, went with Marion Cotillard over Ellen Page. I stuck with Ellen Page as my favorite female performance of the year, but we want to know what you think. So go to filmspotting.net and make your voice heard. Tell us who should win the Best Actress Oscar. Let's get into the feedback then, Maddie, because we really did get so much great feedback on our top five love scenes last week, tying in, of course, with Valentine's Day. And it really was our top five sex scenes, memorable sex scenes in cinema. Peter Whalen here has a great one.
He says, please don't tell me that three of my most trusted film minds are going to completely ignore Mookie and Tina and Do the Right Thing. Well, I thought that you guys put together a very good list and has always gave me my fuel for my Netflix fire. I have to say I'm a little disappointed to see that you omitted this classic scene from your countdown. The culmination of this god-awful day and the lengths that Mookie has to go in order to convince Tina to have sex with him provide for some comedy, and in my mind, portraying the act as more enjoyable for the female participant is quite rare in cinema. Also considering that this is the last moment of calm and serenity we will see in this film makes it all the more poignant. Great points.
It is a great point. It's a great pick. You're going to hear this a lot, but I can assure you I'm not lying. Almost every film that our listeners mentioned were in my short
list. It was like number 6 or 7
or 15. Do the Right Thing was certainly one that I considered. And I do want to mention a film I saw at Sundance called A Good Day to Be Black and Sexy. Has a great scene, an entire chapter built around that whole idea of the act being more enjoyable for the female participant. It's actually maybe probably the most fun chapter in that film.
Absolutely love those scenes with the ice cubes.
Yeah, the ice cube scenes are great and Do the Right Thing here. Let's get on to this one from Wayne from the D.C. suburbs. He was glad to see Don't Look Now and Mulholland Drive on my list, and he says, here are two of my favorites that weren't mentioned, probably because they were funny as hell. Annie Hall, Alvy forcing Andy to have sex without marijuana, so she gets up out of her body to wait till it's over. And there's actually a connection in Cassandra's Dream where a character, the female character, just has had sex with Ewan McGregor, and she gets up and she says, where were you during that? It seems like you were out of your body, or she says something like that. And of course, instantly I was thinking of Annie Hall. And then Wayne says, Being There.
Oh, great, great choice.
The Peter Sellers movie. Chance says, I like to watch. So Eve, Shirley MacLaine, interprets this as a tendency towards voyeurism. She pleases herself loudly while he ignores her and watches TV. Great picks.
Yeah, I absolutely love Peter Sellers in that film. He's sort of doing his homage to Stan Laurel. I like to watch. It's beautifully, beautifully done. Moving on to an email from Emily. No location given. Please remember, when you do write in, include your location. We like to know where you're from. First of all, let me start out with saying that I absolutely love you guys, and the following criticism in no way reflects any larger misgivings about the show. That being said, I was a little disappointed, although not really that surprised, to hear the top picks for this week. Save for Adam's pick for Mulholland Drive, still a bit unfortunate, but at least it's no Wild Things. These scenes of heteronormative baby-making, I like that phrase.
Me too.
Exclude a whole population of your listenership, who also happen to celebrate Valentine's Day, by the way. Come on, a couple of cool cats like yourself, I'm not that cool, can be a bit more open-minded in this day and age. What about Greg Araki's Totally Effed Up? And surely any scenes in Bound can rival Body Heat. Yawn, my parents watched that. That's enough.
I like
Emily.
That jab at you, Maddie.
Oh, perhaps when you guys do Best Movie Kisses, you'll at least take a look at a little Brokeback action. Now there's a kiss.
Nicely done, Emily. I was expecting this email, and I do want to say for the record that I considered the Brokeback Mountain scene. As I said, this was going to come up a lot here, but I certainly consider Brokeback Mountain, and Bound was another one. I actually suggested it for Massacre Theater, and you were right in saying maybe a little bit too obscure for Massacre Theater, but the fact is that's a great scene between Jennifer Tilly and Gina Gershon. I think it may come up here on some other list, but great picks. I don't know that we really have an excuse for it other than, of course, this is what you maybe can expect from two heterosexual males talking about their favorite love scenes. We tried to be as open-minded as possible. They just didn't make the cut. Blake from Boston, Massachusetts says, I must say that I enjoyed and agreed with your picks for top five love scenes, albeit listening to three grown men talk about sex was a little sobering. We did have Keith Phipps from the AV Club on as well. But I'm stunned. Out of not 10 but 15 opportunities, the glaring omission of E Tu Mama Tambien had to be mentioned. I know this film might be teetering towards the penalty box with it being included in your recent coming-of-age picks. However, the pivotal sex scene in which Anna, Julio, and Tanakh culminate their journey with self-realization and true feelings coming to fruition should have made it to the top of the list. P.S. Adam, never say positions again.
I do second that. I have to say, I really, really like my top five. E Tu Mama Tambien, I consider it, mm-hmm. but it was a strong number eight or number nine on my list.
I'm right there with you. It is a great pick, Blake.
Okay, here's coming from El Duderino in Lisbon, Portugal. Number five, Crank, sex, literally as a matter of life and death. Anchorman, Pleasure Town, pandas, unicorns, and a rainbow. And Tom Jones, of course. Three, The Idiots, for its innocence and earnestness, not because Von Trier hired porn stars to have real sex on screen. Number two, Quadrophenia. Apparently, to this day, you can still hear about people going to Brighton to have sex in that alley. And number one, The Big Sleep. You know that exchange about horse riding in which Bacall says she likes to see the horses work out a little first? And then Bogart tells her she's got to touch a class, but he doesn't know how far she can go? To which she replies, a lot depends on who's in the saddle. That's explicit sex, as far as I'm concerned.
Well played, El Duderino. Let's go ahead and close out with this one from Wade in Minneapolis. I'm surprised no one mentioned the threesome scene from A Clockwork
Orange.
Why
would anyone mention the threesome scene from A Clockwork Orange?
Because I do think that is an eminently memorable sex scene in cinema. Of all the strange things that happen in that movie, the strangest is seeing a sex scene in fast motion set to the William Tell overture. Not the most titillating scene, but absolutely bizarre.
No, he is right. And another one I also kind of considered in the same vein was the national anthem scene from Short Bus.
Sure. Yeah, you had to consider that one, but I didn't really want to get into that on air. But again, we got a great batch of feedback here. I wish we could get to more. Thanks to everyone who wrote in. And as always, if you have any feedback for us, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Time for another quick break. When we come back, it's not Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. It's Adam and Maddie and Fanny and Alexander. Stay with us.
But in her head, she dreams of pretty things like those visions from the stories Dora told across there. Almost cuts in her tight hold, her body's in his arms, but her heart's in space. She's left.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider in spoken word entertainment. Audible has over 35,000 titles to choose from to be downloaded and played back anywhere, just like FilmSpotting. Log on to audible.com/FilmSpotting to get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. That's audiblepodcast.com/FilmSpotting for your free audiobook.
The clerk said he had a bruise in his face.
Okay. He had a bruise on his face. That's a hell of a lot less than he deserves. Listen, Bill, I don't think you realize what kind of trouble you were in last night. Who do you think those people were? Those were not just ordinary people there. If I told you their names, I'm not going to tell you their names, but if I did, I don't think you'd sleep so well.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. That's Adam Kempinar. It's time now for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I massacre a beloved scene, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a beloved DVD of your choice. Now, last week we massacred the scene you just heard with Tom Cruise and Sydney Pollack from Eyes Wide Shut, a tie-in with our top five love scenes. And I have to say, I didn't really push for Eyes Wide Shut. Not my favorite film.
No, but it is a film I like. There you go. So not every film in Massacre Theater is beloved, obviously, though.
Nor do I think it's that romantic.
No,
either.
It isn't, as Taylor Amato in D.C. wrote in. You guys are sick. For a Valentine's Day top five love scenes theme Film Spotting, you do Eyes Wide Shut. There's nothing romantic about this movie. There's plenty that is sexual, but nothing romantic. We don't disagree, but when it comes to memorable sex scenes, I think that the Fidelio sequence near the end of Eyes Wide Shut stands out. That is why we picked it. Also got a great email from Harold Rauser from Tübingen, Germany, who writes, Cruise and Pollock, two of the worst actors in film history.
That's fighting words.
That is fighting words. I guess Harold wouldn't cast Cruz and Pollock in his movie.
If you need a district attorney or the head of a law firm, you're going to Sidney Pollack.
Or an ethically challenged doctor or lawyer.
Exactly.
He's your man.
There you are. All right, Adam, we'll reach into the film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Tyler Lyon from Iowa City, Iowa.
Well, you know, I know where that is. And of course, you spent some time there.
Go Hawks, my old stomping grounds. Congratulations, Tyler. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Ta-tay-tee-toe-too.
No, no, Miss Lamont, round tones, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and Maddie is getting ready, getting
the types. I'm just
trying
to suck the talent out of me.
Okay, because this one does tie in with our top five actors we wouldn't cast in our movie. So think about bad actors. That's all we're going
to
say.
Right, this is a tricky little one, we have
it
to say.
It is a tricky scene. I am predicting right now we're throwing down the glove, throwing down the challenge. This may be the least entered Massacre Theater ever.
I think so.
Which always does end up inspiring more people to try
step
and
up.
Play.
Step so, up, Film Spotting Nation.
Let's see what happens. You started off. I'm going to give you the action, Maddie.
Okay.
And action.
I didn't do anything wrong. You saw my notes. Everything was in there. I got tricked. I got fooled. I'm sorry. What are you being so mad for?
It was 10 people?
Yes.
For dinner?
Yes.
They're closed at 3 on Sundays.
Yeah, I know. I know. They almost didn't let us in, okay? But it was a couple minutes before 3, and Ian looked like he was about ready to cry, and so they said okay.
But for dinner?
Go in and ask them yourself, Chuck, okay? Go in and see if they would serve a party that came in at 2:58, and the answer would be yes, because that's when we got here.
The Forbes guys are going to have all this, too.
I didn't do anything wrong,
Chuck.
They're
going to dig through the records at that office building. I'm sure they have surveillance cameras, and they're going to check them.
I didn't do anything wrong, Chuck.
I really wish you'd stop saying that.
And see. Wow, I don't know if we massacred that one.
We may not have. Seriously, Maddie, stop saying that. I'm serious. Well, if you know what film we just massacred, email your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback@filmspotting.net by Wednesday, February 27th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit filmspotting.net. We're finishing off our Bergman Marathon with Fanny and Alexander, Bergman's 1982 film that was originally intended to run as a four-part TV miniseries. It was later released in a 188-minute cinematic version, which is what you and I reviewed this week. A quick plot recap, as best as I can do without editorializing. Fanny and Alexander are born into a well-off family from an eccentric theatrical background. Their father dies, fittingly, on stage, and their mother, Emily, remarries the local bishop. Fanny and Alexander move in with their mother to the bishop's very sort of bleak and austere house. The bishop treats Alexander very cruelly. There's a plot to free the children from the house, throw in a magical Jewish antiques dealer and the dead father's ghost, and there you have it.
Yeah.
At the time, Bergman said this was going to be his last feature film. Turned out it wasn't true. Yet, I think it's fitting we close our marathon with it. And also at the time of its release, critics were rather divided on the film. Mr. Kempinar, where do you fall? Is this a fitting masterpiece to capstone our marathon, or did Mr. Bergman's talents ebb since his earlier works?
Well, I haven't yet decided if Fanny and Alexander is going to get my Best Picture prize in our marathon awards next week, but I wouldn't begrudge anyone who said that not only is Fanny and Alexander not a step back or a sign of his skills as a filmmaker slipping, I think it just might be his zenith, actually. Mm. It's a culmination, too, of everything we've seen in this marathon. The search for and silence of God comes up, our capacity to be inhumane and hurtful to those we love and those we don't love, just all the anguish that comes with being alive, it's all on display here. But then there's also humor and love, and the movie reveals our capacity to be kind and generous. And certainly by the end of it, it's a very optimistic and hopeful film, I think. And the grandiosity and the warmth of the Ekdahl house, this Ekdahl mansion, and those Christmas days and nights with the glow of the lights, Sven Nykvist's amazing cinematography.
Oh, the colors are just
the
so
green
beautiful.
And the reds, those hues are so gorgeous that it managed to warm up my chilly little living room.
Well, I have to tell you, I think I emailed you this. I told you, I started the film. I had to shut it off because, you know, every time we're about to review a Bergman film, you know, I go to the library, I learn a couple new words because I want to sound really, really smart because I feel like I'm out of my element. And it turns out every single time we watch one, it's ridiculous that I even think about doing that because his films are so accessible, even when he's dealing with subjects like death
That's a
and
great
war.
Point.
And here, it's for me, it's family. you know, I walk away. It's just like these images and what he's able to accomplish sort of stick me in the gut like a fire poker and just sort of pull my guts out. It's that riveting. And that Christmas, you know, we didn't have the opulence that these people had.
No.
But, you know, we sang Yuli Yuliana, Yuli Yuliana. And you know, they had the Yule Baka out. They had the Tomta out. And it really made me think about family and how my own family exists in my memories. And you see this Christmas through the eyes of the child, Alexander. And think about, you know, we all have that drunken uncle, you know, who only exists in our memories as that one uncle that showed up every Christmas for about 15 minutes mm-hmm. and did something really funny, like the uncle here.
Yeah.
And the what's wondrous about Fanny and Alexander is then we actually get to see the rest of his life. We don't just have to see the 15 minutes that Alexander gets. We actually get to see what else went into making that little character in our lives.
Yeah, no, it really is wondrous. And in some ways, you know, I've read about the fact that this is maybe Bergman's most autobiographical film, mm-hmm. and yet supposedly maybe an embellishment, maybe the childhood he wished he had. And I can say maybe it's the childhood Christmas I wish I had. We didn't have these kind of opulent grand dinners and the singing and everything, but watching it is so much fun mm-hmm. to go down that path with these people.
But it's not the grand dinner, or, you know, the grandiosity of it. It's the family. It's
you're,
the
you're
love
right.
that's there. And if you think about Bergman's childhood, actually, this is sort of a reverse, because he was raised by all reports, a very strict Lutheran pastor.
Maybe
for
like
father.
The bishop we see later.
Exactly. And so when Alexander is taken to live in this sort of Calvinist household, it's sort of the opposite of what happened to Bergman. He went off to be with the theater folk.
Yeah, exactly. And I do think that that speech at the end of this film that mirrors the speech we get early in the film, the one at first is Oscar, the father who dies, and he kind of knows maybe something's wrong, that he's getting to his last days, and he's talking to the theater troupe. And then we get it later with the uncle, talking to the theater troupe. And those speeches, especially at the end, the idea of the two worlds, I think, is so great and really so moving in a lot of ways, where you've got the real world and you've got the theater world or the fantasy world. And it's perfectly embodied in the fact that Oscar is playing Hamlet when he dies and then shows up as a ghost to his son and his wife also later. But you see these two worlds, how brutish and how awful the real world is, and we see that on display in this film. And then that's exactly why, as the uncle explains at the end of the film, why you need the little world. You have to take the pleasures in that little world, in each other, in family, in friends, in that troop of people. And it's so moving. It's such an embrace of humanity, which is so nice to see coming off a movie like Shame, for example, or
right.
even Winter Light.
No, I think you're exactly right. Although I will say one of the scene that really, really stays with me is also its most frightening. And that's when Alexander is woken in the middle of the night by his mother's screams. And these are not just regular screams. They are feral. And Nyquist just follows him down the staircase.
His grandmother actually is the one.
Is it his grandmother mm-hmm. screaming?
It's her son that's died.
It was so disturbing. It was wondrously
yeah,
good.
It is terrifying there. And I think the movie, what really drew me into it, that split between the real world and fantasy world, we see that kind of schism between reality and mm-hmm. fantasy play out in other ways too. We see the upstairs downstairs of the rich people and the servants. And then we also see it with the religion. The Ekdals, when they're celebrating Christmas, they do it with the familiar stories about Jesus. Mm-hmm. It's all New Testament. It's all about love and forgiveness. And then you have the Bishop Vergaris, who embodies everything about the Old Testament wrath. Mm-hmm. It's all about subservience and stifling imagination and following rules. And then you have to look at this film, of course, coming from Bergman, as a comment on religion, in the fact that Emily turns to this guy, to this bishop, in her time of desperation, and she does so completely, not reading any of the signs that we as a viewer all see. This is going to end badly.
Yeah.
You do not want to marry this guy. But she does it in such a way. She's desperate. She needs a husband. She thinks she does anyway. She needs a father. Her husband's just died. She turns to this bishop, certainly who is a godlike figure, and then she's just absolutely crushed by it. I mean, if you want to make the case that, you know, religion is the opiate of the masses, we see it here. She turns to religion in her time of need, and it destroys her.
No, you're absolutely right. And it takes Alexander's turning to fantasy to destroy that character, destroy that religious figure.
Another haunting scene. How about the scene with Ishmael, played by a
female
actress? Female. Yeah.
And
which
no
you
questions
can
asked.
Tell, but,
yeah.
Oh, man. That one as well. Very creepy. The cross-cutting between the fate we see of the bishop.
Oh, and the puppet god
the
coming out
there.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Some great stuff. It really is a fantastic film. We will say we both agreed on this. I mean, everyone says this, I think, but the first half of this film is very deliberate, to say the least. You kind of are just being introduced to these
people.
It's
very, very sprawling. No studio is going to put out a film like this anymore, unfortunately. But that's what I really loved about it, is you get to meet all these characters that are kind of going to fall away as the story goes on. But it just invests you in this world.
It does.
So
and then
well.
Once the plot does kick in, where we get the story of how are they ever going to escape this mean old bishop, who really is awful. I mean, really a great villain and a great performance, too. You know, then you are even more invested in it than obviously you were before. And it does pay off, I think, richly by the end of the film. So Fanny and Alexander is the last film in our Bergman Marathon. We'll finally put a bow on the Bergman Marathon next week by announcing our Bergman Marathon Awards. We'll give out our best picture and best actor. And I have to read this email here, Maddie. We got a great one from Oscar in Stockholm, Sweden, who wrote in and said he's got a suggestion for the name of the awards. We always name them, but we don't have one yet for the Bergman Marathon. So we want your suggestions. But Oscar says we should call them the God is Deads. Like, and the God is Dead for best performance by Max von Sydow goes to Max von Sydow as the Knight in the Seventh Seal. If you've got something better than Oscar, please send it to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Time for one last quick break. Up next, no, really, you were great. We'll keep in touch. The top five actors Adam and I wouldn't cast in the Holland movie. Stay with us.
She sleeps through the sirens. She don't awake for dead rays. While this morning headlines don't cross her mind, let's leave her that way. She sleeps through the sirens, unaware of all the pain. But don't wake her with bad news now while she dreams of beautiful things.
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD, brought to you by TLAvideo.com. The world of film at your fingertips.
We're going to mention six movies here, Maddie. I think we would both agree that the first one we should highlight, the Darjeeling Limited. The extras include Hotel Chevalier, the short film that you could watch on iTunes for free. It's got a deleted scene of featurette and trailers. Maybe not the big edition of Darjeeling we expect to be coming at some point down the road. We were mixed on this movie, though we both did recommend it and like certain things about it. It wasn't a movie that we wholeheartedly embrace, but that film is out now, coming out on Tuesday. Beowulf also out, a movie we sort of trashed, and I'm not sure that
I can imagine watching this on a DVD
makes a whole lot of sense. Yeah. But if you want to check that one out, Slipstream. I wanted to mention this one, Maddie, because it's the first film, I believe, Anthony Hopkins making his directorial debut here. He also wrote it. It played at Toronto, and we both failed to get to it there in Toronto, but that movie really experimental and out there.
It came out here really briefly here in Chicago.
I think it played at the
Film
Fest,
too. I remember Ebert really liking it, or at least, you know, sort of promoting it.
Yeah, I want to check it out now. 30 Days of Night, a movie we skipped. Vampire film. Goya's Ghost, Maddie, a movie, unfortunately,
we
didn't skip.
One that I couldn't skip. Ouch. Skip it on DVD, though.
Natalie Portman in that film. And then The Last Emperor, kind of our classic pick of the week, the Bertolucci film, a Criterion Collection release, digitally remastered, bonus footage, an audio commentary by Bertolucci and the producer, documentaries, a whole lot of stuff in that release.
I always end up watching The Last Emperor at least once every 4 years.
Really?
I don't know how, and I'm always sort of sucked into watching this film.
Well, it is a great film, and again, out now. You can get all the DVDs we mentioned in this segment at great prices through TLAvideo.com. Support TLA, support Film Spotting. Just click on the Film Spotting movie store link at filmspotting.net.
All right, well, now we want to take a moment to, of course, Mr. Kempinar, thank everyone who found their way over to filmspotting.net and threw a couple of their hard-earned dollars our way. We appreciate every single dollar that we get, and we thank you, thank you, thank you. And as a little token of our gratitude, here are your patented Sam Van Halgren Film Spotting nicknames for one last week. Two
That's
more.
That's right.
Two
well,
more
weeks. Next week is going to be it.
That's
Episode
it.
200. So your last chance, really, I do want to say real quick here, this coming Sunday, February 24th, really, if you want to get it in for that 200th episode, you want Sam to say it on air, that's your chance. So try to get it in if you want to donate.
Okay, here we go. Clayton, Comfortably Numb. Jeremy, About de Souffle. Daniel, Feeling a Little Feral. Jason, Bad Mouthing Ivan. Richard, Pneumonia Burgers. Kimberly, Very Racy. Andrew, Kafka-esque Kafka Kafka. Nathaniel, Still Brooklyn Across the Park. Kevin, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Every Other Thursday. Brian, The German Flair, a.k.a. Government Cheese. It's a Silver Club donor. Thank you very much, Brian. Jim, Stuck in the Radiance. Lori, Tennis is an Illusion. Rebecca, Ashcan Kitty. Peter, The Philistine Jock. Jason, Studio Genius. Will Final Edit, another Silver Club donor, and Matthew Jumpcut Degola. Also, Sarah, Age Appropriate Donation Delivery Device, a Gold Club donor. Thank you very much, Sarah. And that is in honor of?
In honor of this week's theme. I think that probably gives it away. This is Sam, of course, trying to get his pick in for our upcoming top five here. Actors we wouldn't cast in our film, memorably, Laura Linney. This film, of course, The Squid and the Whale, he is referencing here with these nicknames. I do want to say thank you, of course, to Brian BRK, my good friend from college, donating some of his money. And I do want to point out Jason Studio Genius L and Jason Badmouthing Ivan E. Thank you again to everyone who donated.
This is Craig Brewer, the director of Black Snake Moan, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
You knew me right away.
It took me a moment, but yes, I knew.
Could have said something.
I thought you'd figure it out eventually.
Yes, I would have. I would have come another night, volunteered, walked right on stage and said hello, and then you'd really have had to move quickly.
I suspect you would have.
You are listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie, and it is time to get into our top five for this week. The top five actors we wouldn't cast in our movie, and you just heard a scene from The Illusionist, a movie with Ed Norton. Now, Ed Norton is not going to make either of our lists in this case, but I will say he came close only because The Illusionist is actually a film reviewed here on Film Spotting before your time, Maddie, that sparked a debate between myself and your predecessor, Sam, about the merits of Ed Norton. I really liked him in that film. Sam did not, but when discussing this top five list with Sam earlier this week, I wanted to know if he had any recollections of actors I constantly ripped on the show. He mentioned that Ed Norton, while I like him, nevertheless is that actor who you can count on being in your film who's going to totally derail it and do whatever he wants to do with the movie.
He draws a lot of focus.
Yeah. He's also the guy, though, that behind the scenes is going to be rewriting the script and determining the direction and where it's going. I think we both decided not to go with those kind of outside things. We're just sticking with what's on the screen and whether or not that really worked for us. So Ed Norton, not on the list, but I do want to hear who made your list. And I know, Maddie, from talking to you about this a little bit, that this was a really hard list for you.
Yeah, really, really hard.
And I wonder, is that because you were kind of sticking with your acting brethren and didn't really want to rip on some of these people? Or do you just not have that many actors you dislike?
Well, it's a matter that I'm really, really reticent to say sort of blanketly that someone is a bad actor. Because when they're on film and they get to that level, that is very, very rarely true, that someone is a bad actor.
Agreed.
Talent in this industry will always out. There are, of course, exceptions. But for the most part, the people that you see on screen have worked really, really hard to get there and are very, very, very talented to get there. I have no compunctions, and I have said it on the show, saying, God, that was a terrible performance. Mm-hmm. He or she was really bad in that. But to end up on my list, you basically kind of had to just sort of rub me the wrong way over a period of time.
No, that's a great point.
It's really not a reflection on their talent.
Maybe not. And I will say, too, before I get to my list, that if you look at the Film Spotting message boards, there's already a list on this topic called Top 5 Off-Putting Actors. And even that name is telling. If you look at the explanations from our very smart listeners, you'll notice that in most cases, it's hard for any of them to really articulate why they dislike these actors. There is just something off-putting about them. And I'm no different. I think evaluating acting is probably the most subjective aspect of any film to critique. So when you try to put your finger on exactly what makes an actor bad, it's really hard.
Yeah, it is. And it's very, very easy to say Tom Cruise is a bad actor.
Sure.
I don't buy it for a second. Tom Cruise actually is a very, very talented actor.
But he may really bug you.
Yeah, he may jump up on a couch and, you know, proclaim his love on Oprah for Kate Holmes or be, you know, the high moolah of Scientology. That could really rub you the wrong way. Or even, you know, you meet someone in your daily life and they might rub you the wrong way. Mm-hmm. So this, again, not a reflection on whether or not I think they can act.
Okay.
For the most part.
I understand.
Now, my number five, however, is Anna Paquin. I just sort of have to ask what happened. And I have this sort of silly little theory, and it applies to a lot of child actors, people who are really, really good when they were young, because they were so uninhibited. They were kids. They just sort of, they don't know how to overthink things. They're just playing a situation very, very truthfully. And I think once you grow older, you hit puberty, you just sort of get a little bit more self-conscious. And I think that reflects in her acting now.
Well, I think that's a great point. And actually, it perfectly does tie in with my number five. Before I get there, I do want to say that you could maybe quibble with my number two choice here a little bit. But I did try to go, and I'm sure you did too, only with people who are actually in some demand, people who are getting work.
Yes.
I'm not going to throw out Steven Seagal and Rob Schneider here, though I think that would maybe be a fun movie to watch for those two. Maybe a nice buddy pairing there. But I did try to stick with actors who you could actually see quite a bit in cinema. But my number five is Natalie Portman. And I'm right there with you. I made a note about the fact that I don't know that she's ever been as good or as natural on screen, mm-hmm. except maybe as a kid in her breakout movie, The Professional. And by all accounts, she's an incredibly smart...
And beautiful girls. Beautiful girls.
Yes, she's good in that as well. I have that here. But she's incredibly smart. A real grounded person seems to be. And she's probably a great person to have around the set. I do not hate her by any means. That's why she's number five. I like a lot of the movies she's in. The Professional, Heat, Beautiful Girls, Closer, I even like. I know you hate it. I'm pretty sure I even gave her a lot of credit with V for Vendetta. I thought she was maybe the best thing about that film, but I've just never found her to be natural on screen. I
really?
Just think,
wow.
Like everyone on my list, she always seems to be acting. She's always trying too hard for me, and there is something about her that puts me off.
The only time that was apparent for me was in Closer, actually.
And I really noticed it in Garden State, a movie I like, but there
she's trying to be so precocious. Oh, no. She's terrific in Garden State.
I disagree.
All right. Okay, my number four. I have to say this to you, Adam. Not all stand-up comedians can act. A lot of them can. Michael Keaton, Martin Lawrence, Cedric the Entertainer, Jim Carrey, all can act. They just sort of have that built-in gene. But just because you can make people laugh doesn't automatically make you an actor.
Are you going Eddie Murphy on us?
No. Eddie Murphy, one of the greatest talents of the 1980s.
I agree. Did you list him there? Was I not listening
close
enough?
I'm getting there. Okay. This is a nice build.
Okay,
this is a little rule for everybody.
Go for it.
Okay, Chris Rock, not the best actor. Don Rickles, not the best actor. Dane Cook, not the best actor. But Exhibit A is Donald Logue. Yeah, you guys would recognize him from The Tao of Steve and Grounded for Life, the reality show, and small little
the
character
groomsman
parts.
He's really good in. You don't like
Donald
Logue?
No, he's the one person I watch acting. I'm like, take a class. He's really, really wooden. And I don't say that lightly. I really don't. I watch it and I'm like, oh, come on. No way, man.
Well, what role? Is there one in particular that jumps out?
Tao of Steve.
You don't like
was
him
the
there.
Big one. That's the big one. Oh, The Patriot. He has this small character role in The Patriot where he has to say things. You know, he has this relationship with this emancipated slave and something, you know, at the end, I'm really proud to be fighting with you here today. He can't, he doesn't pull it off? He can't pull it off.
Okay.
Of course, who really can pull that? Well, Mel Gibson can pull it off.
Maybe.
But, yeah.
Well, a good choice there. I'm going to alienate a few more female listeners here maybe with my number four, and I'm going with Scarlett Johansson. Like Natalie Portman, I think she is always trying too hard, always a little bit unnatural. And I think I actually, at one point, I referred to her on the show during one of our poll questions about Scarlett Johansson as the female Keanu Reeves. If you look at a movie like The Black Dahlia,
or
Match
Keanu
Point,
doesn't deserve that.
He's not on my list, but you know, you get my point. But if you look at a couple films she's been in recently, like The Black Dahlia or Match Point, where she's trying to be a sort of femme fatale, she isn't ever seductive. She's always playing seductive. And then you add that husky voice into the mix. Again, it's totally subjective. I just don't like it. And listening to her try to be like a Barbara Stanwyck-type character and have that presence and have that voice, it's just not even close. Yeah. And coming up, maybe even next week on the show, we may be discussing the new movie, The Other Boleyn Girl, which stars Natalie Portman and Scarlett Johansson.
Wow.
It might be like crossing the streams for me, where the world might close in on itself or something with them on screen together. I don't know, but we'll see what happens.
Go get them, Ray. Well, I have to say, yeah, you're right. She, in every film, she just doesn't look happy to be there.
No.
Oh, my God. It looks like she's sulking through the whole thing.
It's true.
All right. Well, my number three, a favorite of yours, Jake Gyllenhaal. I don't get the fascination with this guy. I really never have. I mean, I understand the puppy dog eyes. They're cute. But you shouldn't get credit if your sister can act.
That's a good line.
Eric Roberts doesn't get credit, okay?
No, that's true. He doesn't. Well played. Okay, well, my number three, another great segue here, Maddie, because I referenced Gyllenhaal here when I mentioned my number three, and I am going with Hayden Christensen. He's the guy who inspired this list. I know it's a little bit like beating a dead horse, the fact that he is in Jumper. We thought maybe we'd do this top five.
We kind of talked about this. I'm not seeing him that much. I really think Nick Stahl is probably beating him out for most roles.
And I hope he is, but the fact is he was in Awake, he's in Jumper, he's in two new movies coming out. The guy is getting work, and like Scarlett Johansson, I think his voice for me is at least part of the problem. There is just an awkwardness to it, and his entire demeanor in general. I know that with Anakin Skywalker. There was obviously a lot of pressure on him with that role, but at least 90% of the line readings in those Star Wars movies are just absolutely painful to watch. And I left out a guy like Jake Gyllenhaal in favor of Hayden Christensen because the fact is I like Jake Gyllenhaal in Donnie Darko and Brokeback Mountain and as a Boy Scout in Zodiac even. You just can't cast Jake Gyllenhaal as the smartest guy in the room because even if he is a really smart guy, he just can't project that. And frankly, I can't think of any role necessarily that Hayden Christensen would be right for. There isn't one.
Well, I'm not going to hold Star Wars against any actor
that was in that.
That's Lucas. I mean, as Harrison Ford said filming the first one, you can type this crap, but you certainly can't act it.
Yeah.
Hayden Christensen isn't a big part of my life, so
okay.
I didn't think of him. So my number two, though, a lot of people do love this person. It is Drew Barrymore. She's cute as a button. I love her interviews. I love how game she is for projects. I think she's a really, really nice person, but she's one of the few people, while watching her, I actually go, really, that's the best take that they went with?
Hmm.
You know, seriously? I took in Lucky You this weekend, this gambling movie with Eric Bana, just because Eric Bana was in it and Robert Duvall, which was really, really poorly received. I didn't think it was a terrible movie, but you're watching it and you're sort of watching Eric Bana and he's kind of got the Matty Robinson face on doing the same thing, being like, wow, this is what we're going with.
This is what I'm getting.
This is what we're getting. And it's almost like she's adopted this sort of pseudo-realistic style mm-hmm. now where she kind of underplays every line yep. and just says kind of, And, you know, I'm worried Shia LaBeouf is going to go down that same path.
Yeah.
It's like they're doing Lee Strasberg playing Hyman Roth, only they're not Lee Strasberg doing Hyman Roth. It's a slippery slope.
Yeah. No, that is a great choice. And I have to say, there were four people that were on my honorable mentions. I completely forgot about Drew Barrymore, and she has really driven me nuts ever since even that small role in Donnie Darko. I think she's just awful in that movie. You're right. In general, I don't like her much either. Well, my number two, okay, this is one, again, I maybe beating a dead horse here a little bit, but I'm sorry, he's still getting jobs. Cuba Gooding Jr. I think he's probably always been
Are you kidding me?
An over actor a little bit. He's always one of those guys who's a little too big, going back maybe even to Boys in the Hood. Hey, this is the top five actors we wouldn't cast in our movie. I would not cast Cuba Gooding Jr. I did like
him. You don't want talented people on the set.
No, listen, no, I do like him as Rod Tidwell in Jerry Maguire, and we talked about American Gangster. I thought, ironically, he was actually really restrained as a Harlem pimp in a small role in that film. I think he's really good. But generally, ever since Jerry Maguire, I swear, if you watch any dramatic role he's in, it's like in every scene he's trying to win another Oscar.
Yeah,
or trying
you're
to
right.
Prove
that's a good
he
point.
He deserved the
that's
Oscar.
A good point.
The emotional aspect of the scene is just amplified times a million now every time he does a role, and it drives me crazy.
Yeah, he does kind of get that sort of earnest face with his lips.
Teary eyes a little bit. He's going to break down.
You're right.
It's hard to watch. I know.
You know, you're right.
It's not a great pick. But
I have to say, you almost had me convinced with that
one. Okay, thank you.
All right, well, my number one, maybe just a little bit too easy, but it's Julia Stiles. And I have to say, Miss Stiles, the offer to marry me is still out there. But this is, I'm going to take this from Ben Brantley of the New York Times, his review of Shakespeare in the Park's Twelfth Night. Stiles delivers her lines clearly in a tense, all-American voice that recalls the young Jane Fonda. She gives them little shading, and she has a tendency to over-accent the meter and rhymes in the verse. I think that's what bugs me so much watching her on film. She over-accents things, and I can tell that she is reading a line, that she's actually saying a line, and it completely removes you from the film-going experience.
I'm right there with you. I can't add to anything you said or what Mr. Brantley said. Well done. My number one, let's go ahead and hear a scene.
You know, see, you bitch and you complain and you tell me these things, these mean that. If you think you're preparing me for hard times, thank you, but.
But you gotta be a hero. You wanna be a champion. Well, let me tell you, people don't want a champion. They wanna eat cheeseburgers, play the lotto, and watch television.
Hey, how did you get like this? I wanna know.
Sam, of course, had Laura Linney. I have Brad Pitt to be my whipping boy, and I'm sorry, maybe by just the fact that he's the biggest star on this list, that's why he's my number one. A scene there from Seven, a movie I absolutely love, but I think he's pretty terrible in a lot of scenes.
What's in the box? What's in the box?
Exactly, but he is the only actor I can think of who I believe equates busyness with charisma, which is why he is constantly fidgeting. He's either touching his lips, eating food, smoking or chewing a cigar, or in Seven, repeatedly touching the top of his head. I don't know if it's the charisma so much that he's trying so hard to project, or maybe it's just that he's trying too hard to be natural. You talked about with Drew Barrymore. It's the style of acting where he's maybe trying to overcompensate for the fact that he's in a movie and he's trying to make it really natural and raw. I don't know, you know, by having these little tics, but I find those tics insanely distracting to watch, bottom line.
No, I think he's great. Yes, he's made some missteps. I wouldn't put Seven in there. I actually don't like 12 Monkeys. I think he's playing it crazy a little bit in that one.
Yeah.
I didn't like him in Jesse James for some of the same reasons. I think he was trying to do too much.
Yes.
In that movie, he was trying to be too still, and I missed that charisma, you know, that made me fall in love with him in something like Thelma and Louise and True Romance. As what's that character's name?
I don't remember.
Oh, I just love it.
I should know, but I like him in True Romance as well, and the little scene in Thelma and Louise, but again, those are really small scenes. When you ask him to carry a film, I don't know that it works. But again, I even like him in Fight Club too, but lately he drives me nuts.
All right, well, those are our top five actors we wouldn't cast in our movie. Please send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. I'm really looking forward to those. Opening this weekend, Be Kind, Rewind, Vantage Point with Dennis Quaid and Forrest Whitaker, Charlie Bartlett, and Witless Protection with Larry the Cable Guy, who I have to admit, I've got a little soft spot for.
You
Larry
got
the
some blue collar TV in you?
I do.
Is this going to be Maddie's movie minute next week?
Perhaps. I hope so.
Well, next week's show does mark our 200th episode, and we will celebrate with an appearance by former Film Spotting co-host Sam Van Halgren. He's going to participate in a very special edition, we hope, of Massacre Theater and sit in for the top five, which is going to be Film Spotting Discoveries. These are movies that we, the three of us, all owe to Film Spotting, and we love to recognize your Film Spotting discoveries on the show, movies that really you don't think you maybe would have checked out if it wasn't for us talking about them. feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463. We've already received a number of great entries. Next week's review plans, Maddie, are kind of up in the air at this point. We may review Vantage Point. I know you're not interested, but Dennis Quaid.
I love Dennis Quaid, but I've seen that preview since the summer. And
I know.
You know, I'm always hesitant.
Well, I do. They've got me hooked. I want to know what the little twist is. I want to know what they all see in the video.
And I do like me some William Hurt.
Yeah, there you go. And Forrest Whitaker. So we may check that one out, but there's also a lot of other new movies opening this weekend that look somewhat interesting. I referenced The Other Boleyn Girl with Eric Bana and Scarlett Johansson and Natalie Portman. And then Penelope, I don't know that we're going to get to this one, but Christina Ricci and Reese Witherspoon.
This is another one they've been pushing back.
Oh, yeah. I remember we had this on the schedule like 6-8 months ago, but it's just now coming out. So stay tuned to filmspotting.net. Check the calendar page for updates.
Thanks, as always, to our listener volunteers, Alex, Angela, Frank, and Candace. Special thanks to Joe Dassault, Ron Jones, and Tori Malatia at Chicago Public Radio. Thanks also to Mark Pickerel and his Praying Hands and Bloodshot Records for this week's music. Learn more at bloodshotrecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Maddie Ballgame Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips. Learn more by visiting the Film Spotting movie store at filmspotting.net. All right, Massacre Theater. I think... Don't you think we should just cover our bases and let's just say we massacre a scene from a movie and you get a shot at winning it? Let's not do the Beloved stuff.
Oh, I like Beloved.
But it's not always Beloved.
That's all right. That's all right.
I don't know. Doesn't scatological mean like poop? Scatological humor is poop humor.
Is it? I thought scatological was like everywhere.
No, that's like scatterbrained. But scatological means
poop?
Poop.
Nice.
Like, you know, like
that
kind
up.
Of
do we that have the internet?
Yeah,
let's look it up.